Welcome to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. I'm your host, Nathan Oman, Assistant Professor at William & Mary Law School. You can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com. Just look on the left side of the page under the Categories heading and click on Law Talk. There you can find past episodes as well as information on how to subscribe. My guest today is Professor Richard Epstein at the University of Chicago. Thank you, Professor Epstein, for coming on Law Talk.
Nice to be here. I'm actually visiting at NYU from the University of Chicago, so I have two homes at once.
Oh, wonderful. Well, today, Professor Epstein is going to talk about some of his current research. Of course, he's known for publications in a massive variety of different areas, but today we're going to be discussing his work on the classical liberal history of the Constitution and its lost opportunities. What exactly is involved in this project?
Modest little task, and I don't know whether I'll be able to get it done, but I've been asked by Basic Books to write something on constitutional law from the perspective which has been largely discredited, namely that of classical liberalism. And so I suppose essentially what I should do is explain what classical liberalism means, how I thought the Constitution was originally set up, and then something about the opportunities that were lost. And in doing this, it's not easy because whereas a doctrine may be influenced by a system like classical liberalism, it is not its perfect embodiment, so there's always some slippage between what's done in any particular theory of any sort that happens to describe it. So there's a little bit of tugging and hauling at the edges, and things are not quite as neat as I will sort of indicate in the talk. Anyhow.
Now, is your ambition in the book to do a history, of sort of a constitutional history from a classical liberal point of view?
Yeah, I mean, just basically taking the key choices, seeing what the judicial responses to them were, figuring out whether they're consistent with the original plan broadly conceived or not. And if they're not, then try to explain why it is that notwithstanding all the changed circumstances of the time, we were better off with the original arrangement than the one which we have today. There's no open secret, I think, that the central task of constitutional interpretation has always been embarrassed by one single difficulty. You start with a limited government, strong property rights version of the Constitution. And somehow or other you have to twist and turn that in order to come up with the New Deal welfare state, where property rights essentially are always subordinate to administrative procedures. It takes a lot of twisting and hauling to do that on jurisdictional issues having to do with federal-state relations, and also on individual liberties issues having to do with property, speech, religion, and a whole host of other things. And how that history came to pass is essentially, I think, the main topic of this particular of this book. And, you know, it is essentially a fall from the Garden of Eden into not necessarily the dens of hell, because we certainly haven't descended that far. But when you say lost opportunities, it sort of captures the right mode by indicating that I think we've made serious social dislocations, which are highly costly to the system, even though by no means fatal to its operation. The observation that I like to make about the United States is it's amazing how a system with all of its imperfections manages to work at all, to which the answer is we tend to have relatively few compared to other nations which labor under either inferior constitutions or wholly disregard whatever laws and constitutions they happen to have in place on the books.
Now, what do you see as sort of the earliest turning points in this fall from Eden?
This fall from grace? I think it basically it's a pretty late turning point. I mean, you certainly see systematic signs of erosion of the original constitutional order in the so-called Lochner era, a wildly exaggerated term, which dates from the end of the Civil War all the way through the Great Constitutional Revolution of 1937, particularly on matters of whether or not there are any limitations on the way in which the power to tax can be imposed. But the major fall took place with stunning rapidity in a relatively short period in the early 1930s, spurred on by the complexities of the massive depression, whose origins were largely misunderstood, and so therefore whose cures was largely misconstrued. But I don't want to get ahead of the story too much. I think it's probably sensible to give you something about what the classical liberal model is, how it was implemented in the basic constitutional design before we talk about the descent and fall.
Take us back to the Garden of Eden.
Go back, you know, to the near Garden of Eden and figuring out what's going on. Well, I mean, first is a matter of sort of intellectual climate about the time of the United States Revolution. And there are many great heroes. Karl Marx is not one of them, not only because he wasn't born, but because that was not the view of the world. We had on structural issues a lot of affection for Montesquieu, the Frenchman, and his emphasis upon separation of powers. We certainly had a strong affection with respect to some delineation of individual rights based upon John Locke and similar writers. The historical origins of federalism, that is, a two-tier situation with state and federal governments, is a little bit more ambiguous because there certainly is nothing in the general social contract literature, starting from Hobbes and going through people like Hume and Adam Smith and so forth, which deals with that particular issue. But we had a long inherited experience of doing it because the moment you have a system of colonial rule, there are some things that are left in the colonies, other things that are brought back to London, and essentially a federalist system substitutes a more democratic American system for the British royal system over there in London, far away from the field of action. So we have some historical experience with that. The reason you call it classical liberal is they were not libertarians in the strong sense of that word, thinking in effect that any use of government force to coerce individuals' behavior was not justified unless that individual had committed some kind of a wrong. So if you look at the Constitution, two things are perfectly evident in terms of its basic structure. One is that it was created not to make it impossible for people to tax, but rather to rationalize the system of taxation, to prevent it from being used for creating massive cross-subsidies, but to allowing it to discharge the essential tasks of government. And certainly a strong libertarian has a lot of very serious doubts about taxation. The framers had some about its form, but they had none about the legitimacy of it as a practice. And the second, I think, key difference that was had to do with the issue of eminent domain. If you're a strong libertarian, somebody like my friend Ellen Paul, you're very suspicious of the use of state power to condemn property for anything, including public roads and offices and so forth. Our Constitution recognized the power of eminent domain and tried to put some teeth in the limitations on it through a combination of the public use requirement, the things that you could condemn for, and the just compensation requirement, what you have to pay when you try to condemn them. Both of these are non-libertarian, but they're perfectly consistent with limited government kinds of operations. And the theory essentially is that at every point, you wish the government, when it exerts its power, to do so under a set of institutional arrangements that makes it most likely that the people who are subject to its power exertions will benefit from the use of that power. So you want the taxes that are collected from A to go back to A's benefit. If there's going to be an eminent domain, you want to make sure that the guy whose property is taken gets returned compensation in one form or another, so that you do not have a situation where the majority gangs up on the minority, which is one of the constraints you're always worried about, and at the same time, you don't want to let anybody be a kind of a one-man holdout so as to stop government from going forward altogether.
What do you make of the work of historians like Gordon Wood or Bernard Bailyn, who look at the intellectual origins of the Constitution,
see the Republican,
and they see this sort of civic Republican or classical Republican.
Well, Gordon Wood, of course, retracted a large fraction of it in the footnotes of his second book after his first. What they did is I think they fundamentally misunderstood what the Republican tradition was like to the extent that they read it as being inconsistent with the system of neither natural rights, liberties on the one hand, or private property on the other. Republicanism, and I think the best source on this is actually by a lawyer named Mortimer Sell, is not particularly well known, dates, of course, from the Republican institutions of Rome, which is, you know, res publicae means those things which pertain to the public. And the spirit of republicanism that was that for those things which truly belong to the public weal, the only way in which they could be resolved is through democratic discourse and participation and not through sovereign domination. And that means, for example, if you're going to talk about war and pieces of building aqueducts or roads or where you put your public auditoriums and so forth, you don't want one person to have a cobble. But there's nothing about the system of republicanism which says that things private are necessarily going to be subject to the same kind of public scrutiny and debate. And so what happens is you should read republicanism as setting up the institutions for dealing with common problems, but as having no implication for saying that all problems are necessarily common. And I think that the traditional historical view on this, particularly with the classical view on property rights, is that anytime you're talking about waters and roads, it's limited access to all members of the public on roughly equal terms. And at the same time, when you're talking about the houses that are beside the roads or beside the rivers, there is much more of a strong right to exclude all other individuals. And what happened is the Wood-Bailyn situation confuses two traditions. One which talks about how you deal with public goods and services, for which the republicanism is the right answer, and its antidote or its opposition turns out to be monarchy or tyranny. And then the question is whether or not all those things go into the public deliberative space. And there's absolutely no evidence whatsoever that the second proposition is true, simply because the first one is true. But to give you a modern illustration, if I want to pay a worker 2 cents an hour and he's willing to work for it, it's not a matter of public issue because somebody else is paying their employees 2 cents an hour or 5 cents an hour or $20 an hour. Each of us makes our private decisions. The workers decide to accept it or not. So there's no public interest on this view in saying that we have to have a minimum wage. And one of the key sources of decline, if you start to look at the way in which the Constitution gets lost and screwed up, is on exactly this point. There was a classical conception of property which was, quote-unquote, affected with the public interest. And this is a term which dates back to the late 17th century, Sir Matthew Hale. And what he meant by it, in effect, is that in those areas in which a certain private party had either by franchise from the crown, he was an Englishman, or by natural circumstances, a monopoly on certain sorts of facilities, what happened was there was a correlative duty on that person with that monopoly power to charge what they called reasonable and non-discriminatory rates. Couldn't play favorites because there's too much abuse, and on the other hand, you couldn't charge a monopoly rate, you had to charge something closer to the competitive rate. How you get there is a tricky question, but there's no doubt that that doctrine was fully accepted as a monopoly control lever in England. It gets carried over to the United States in about 1876 in a case called Money Against Illinois, which doesn't quite understand how the doctrine works. But through the period from, say, 1876 when Money was decided to about 1934, there was always the sense that the state could regulate on rates to the extent that the party regulated at a monopoly position. And that's perfectly consistent with a classical liberal approach. By the time you get to 1934, there's one of the most dreadful cases in the history of American constitutional law, and one of the lost opportunities is called Nebbia against New York. And here the issue is that the great state of New York decided to prop up milk prices by creating an agricultural cartel. And indeed, virtually every progressive at the time was a champion of some form of cartel or another. They were always cartel makers. They hated competitive markets because they didn't understand their operation. And so what happens is, the question is whether or not these minimum rates for milk, which props up a cartel, deal with an industry which is affected with the public interest. And Justice Roberts, who didn't care about the economics or the political economy, he said, look, if the government could put maximum prices on a public utility, could put minimum prices on a competitive industry, we don't care. And so that meant, in effect, that the government could now get into the cartel-making device. And there's no question, if you go back to the original design, at the very least, they were trying to create open and competitive markets in the United States, create an economic common market for which state barriers would not work. And when you take a doctrine which evolved over long periods of history and turn it absolutely upside down and on its head, you've made a very serious mistake. And the dislocations that have been created by this elaborate system of dairy and by agricultural supports has wrought immense difficulties to the United States. And, you know, my view about it is that you should absolutely prohibit any statute which says that you can't sell at a competitive price but must sell above it. If I could figure out a way to stop the government subsidies on the agricultural front, I would stop that as well. But that's not going to be done through the public interest doctrine. That's the federalism issue. So, I mean, you've got to take all these things into account. And in the original period, they got the public interest stuff about right. And there's no sign, even though there are lots of difficult cases about movie theaters and things like that, there's no sign that they were prepared to take really efficient private competitive markets and to turn them into state cartels. That's the genius of our friend Franklin Roosevelt and the Democratic and to some extent Republican Congresses of the time.
Now, how would you respond to what I was assuming would be the standard rebuttal to your argument, which would be something like, well, many of these doctrines, to the extent that they're applying to state governments, have to do with judicial interpretation of the Due Process Clause.
Well,
we have concerns about empowering judges to make these decisions rather than the democratically elected majorities in the state.
You always have that kind of concern. I mean, but the problem with that argument is, at the very minimum, it always cuts too broadly. I mean, that's an argument for saying, in effect, you have no constitutional restraints on government because you could always be constrained with respect to the abuse. How you trace it out of the Constitution gives rise to another one of the great themes of American constitutional law, which is the over-reliance on the Due Process Clause relative to privileges and immunities. This is a story which jumps forward to the end of the of the Civil War. And there's no question, if you look at the original design of the 14th Amendment, it's actually quite coherent. It talks in somewhat obscure but historically intelligible phrases about having no state shall deny any citizen the privileges and immunities of the citizens of the United, of the several states. And so you get this situation where everybody in the United States who's been made a citizen, and that includes the newly freed slaves, have these privileges and immunities, which essentially include economic liberties. And so you have a pretty clear textual warrant which doesn't involve you taking a term of process, due process, and making it into a series of substantive rights. What they did is they completely gutted the privileges and immunities clause by a 5-4 vote in the slaughterhouse cases. And so now if you're going to get any substantive possession, you're engaged in the most difficult problem of constitutional law. If you mess up the interpretation of one clause, you try to make some sort of corrective adjustments in another. And there's no question that's exactly what they did.
Do you have a particular story about the slaughterhouse cases? Why is it, do you think, that the court got it so wrong in that case?
Well, first of all, there's so many different stories, but the biggest, I think, is that if you look at the actual writing of the 14th Amendment, it is a massive ability of the federal government to restrict the right of the states to do certain kinds of things. It's essentially saying that the federal government becomes the enforcer of a minimum state government at the state level. So not only do you have limited government at the federal level, but you've now completely reversed the original 1789 compromise, which says we've got a federal union, each state can go its own way on any internal matter as it sees fit. And Justice Miller, who wrote the opinion, he says he couldn't believe that it meant what it said. And so, therefore, he just read it to say that the Privileges and Immunities Clause protected only citizens insofar as they were citizens of the United States, which meant that they had the right to cross state lines in order to petition the federal government in Washington. You know, big deal. And, you know, there's a huge debate at the time as to what privileges and immunities mean. But the two schools of thought, which are, you know, tightly balanced, have nothing to do with this. One of them is basically a provision which says that the clause means that there's no discrimination amongst citizens, but leaves a free hand as to what economic regulations you could pose. And the other one says, nope, it doesn't read like a discrimination clause. It's really a substantive guarantee. If you had strong privileges and immunities, you don't have the paradox. But when you don't have them, all of a sudden the due process clause becomes substantive due process, and they get there in a not completely crazy way. What they say is, look, if the legislature passes a statute which is willing to wipe out a particular individual by saying, we're going to reduce the rates that he could charge for his services, right, to 0 cents. There's nothing about that process that the legislature is engaged in which is good, and the reason we know that the process is bad is because the outcome is so terrible. That was their basic kind of theory, and it was introduced in a rape case by Justice Harlan back in the 1890s, and then it kind of mushroomed and covered everything else, but there was little question that if you went back to privileges and immunities, but only to citizens because it doesn't cover aliens, most of the things that were called protected rights by substantive due process would be in the privileges and immunities clause. But that's gone. And so they play constitutional catch-up, and they would rather have this sort of linguistic distortion than have a situation in which the entire plan of the 14th Amendment was gutted by leaving the states as free to regulate after its passage as they had been before. And then the third stage is you introduce a rational basis test, which is, again, another creature of the New Deal, and saying, yeah, we're going to recognize that you have a constitutional right to contract with the property and so forth, but any bad reason that the government could mention is good enough for us, and so therefore you give the right with one clause and then, or one hand, and you take it away with the other. And that's part of the other screw-ups, but there's little doubt that if you actually go back and look at the 14th Amendment, the only thing, new power that the federal government gets is the power to clamp down on state governments. So there should be less government after 1865 than there was before. And it just never seemed to work out that way, to put it mild. And so that's another one of these kinds of opportunities. So if you start thinking about what's going on, essentially if you look at the clauses, they give the government a pretty strong hand to control monopoly, no hand to control the natural liberties of ordinary individuals, which means that ordinary competitive markets are privileged under our constitutional arrangement, which is as should it be, because these are the only way that you produce things that people want. And, you know, instead of having this massive bureaucratic state which can impose rent control in New York and oil price controls in Washington, you have essentially a constitutional guarantee of a relatively free economy.
Now, if the New Deal is the low point in the fall from Eden, are you optimistic about current developments in constitutional law?
No, I think that these guys have gone just worse. I mean, there's a terrible liberal conservative coalition going on, which, you know, you have to scream at the top of your lungs to protest. On the one hand, there are the liberals, many of them, who are very comfortable with big government. They like to pull all the levers. They always think they're smarter than somebody else. And so they could set maximum prices here, zoning regulations there, land use prohibitions in the other place. And they think it will all come out in the wash. And I regard that as delusional. I think once you get beyond the core functions of government, which is to maintain separation, to enforce contracts, and to provide for public goods, you're always asking for trouble. But, you know, they don't believe that. Then they're the conservatives, and many of them essentially have become process conservatives. They don't have a substantive vision. And their argument is, how do we keep the courts from having to decide all of these questions? So even if they have some misgivings about the legislation, they're willing to turn somersaults to make sure that they don't have to intervene. And for example, if you look at the Scalia-Roberts dispute over standing, neither of them wants to basically give taxpayers or citizens the power to attack actions that are ultra vires to government. They take a different approach on that. And my view as a strong libertarian on these issues is, if you've got a government acting ultra vires and there's nobody who's in the direct line of fire, then any citizen should be able to protest the thing and organize a lawsuit so that you could challenge the legality of government actions in court. And that to the extent that you use standing doctrine as a shield, it's like a partial repeal of Marbury and Madison, which you're going to have to justify on some other grounds. And then actually Marbury itself is a very controversial case. It's not clear that it's right. So, you know, you go wheels within wheels on this stuff, but essentially I think it's fair to say that the modern doctrinal approach today is that of deference to administrative bodies because of their supposed expertise, and political bodies supposedly because of their political participation. And my view is both these sets of institutions, if left unwatched, could be hijacked by all sorts of groups to do thoroughly perverse things. And so if you know, you want to take somebody who you would like to really spank in public, you take the senators who are behind the ethanol tax or subsidies. The massive distortion of American markets created by a bunch of people who simply think that if it's good for Iowa or Illinois or Nebraska, it's good for the nation, and you introduce a set of farm distortions, which you could never do in a sane world in which the federal government didn't have a right to intervene in land use decisions. So that's the other fall from grace in this constitutional order. You now got yourself a situation where after Wicked and Silver in the United States can decide how much land gets planted and how much doesn't and who gets paid and who gets punished. Do you know why they were doing that?
Why?
Because they wanted to keep the price of wheat for farmers at $1.16 a bushel when the world price was 40 cents.
When, do you know when,
You understand, this is absolutely madness.
Right.
But, you know, you're going to move the entire Constitution, heaven and earth, to make sure that these guys get a chance to wreck the economy.
Well, it's interesting on the ethanol subsidies. One suspects that the existence of the subsidies has less than the notion of what is good for Illinois is good for the nation, as much as all senators want to be president someday, and what is good for Iowa is good for presidential campaigns.
Senator Grassley, it's a funny battle. I think the original constitutional compromise, which gives two votes to each state in the Senate, basically gives an extraordinary whip hand to small states, and farm states tend to have a lot of Senate power, even though they have relatively little population. But, you know, Barack Obama will talk this line when he's in southern Illinois. And, you know, Chuck Grassley is the big mover of all this stuff. It's a public scandal. I mean, you've managed to wreck every agricultural market, every import market, by creating massive subsidies. And because these guys don't believe that subsidies require taxes and that taxes on other segments reduce production. That's just all academic talk by people who aren't in the real world. But of course, they don't know the first thing about the real world because they've never seen the way a tax worked if their life depended upon it. So you get this constant delusion that every kind of regulation you impose is a free goody for the people who get it, imposing no dislocations on the people who have to fund it. This is living in fantasy land.
When is your book likely to come out?
Well, I have to write it then. I'm in the middle of it right now. I'm trying to turn up the juices. I hope to get it finished by the first of the year, and it'll probably be out, I don't know, 6 months or probably, if I'm lucky, it'll be a year from today. I have another book which I just finished on the history of the Takings Clause, which is coming out from Oxford University Press in, when is that coming out? That's coming out in February or so. And it's called Supreme Neglect. And the theory of that particular book is, if you look at the intellectual mess that's made out of the Takings Clause, what you could say about the Supreme Court is that it has neglected every sensible approach to property rights that's imaginable. So, you know, I don't think these are not small marginal decisions that I'm, you know, disagreeing with. This is just a fundamental frontal assault on everything that's been done in these areas for a good long time. And, you know, it's not particularly fashionable. It doesn't get you in, you know, invitations to fancy Washington clubs. But given the fact that the heavy dominance of opinion, I think, is in fact in the service of most parochial and monopolistic industries and interests, it's really important to speak out about it, because even if you can't change the Constitution, which it's not really possible to do in the short run, I'm not that naive, you could change the climate of opinion so people will be embarrassed. And if you want but one other illustration of that before we go, think back to the Kelo case, right?
Right.
You know, this was, I regard it as a scandalous abnegation of constitutional authority, to simply say whatever Lola wants, Lola gets. And, I mean, the decision that Justice Stevens wrote showed no texture, no responsiveness to the fact. The land that they've ripped these houses on still lays vacant and probably will do so forever. In the great city of New London, at least it hasn't been developed yet. And there was an incredible popular outcry. And, you know, it turns out that it's harder to condemn land for economic development now than it was 2 years ago, even though most of the reform efforts were stopped by the planning lobbies, who are very powerful. It's against the property lobbies. Everybody's a lobby on both sides, which are a little bit weaker. And so what you're trying to do, at least what I try to do, is that you hope to create a climate of opinion so that if the values that you hold dear are internalized by people in the political branches of government, they will act with a little more circumspection than they currently do.
Well, we will look forward to seeing those books come out next year and see what they do to the climate of opinion.
Okay, I hope they work out. Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Thank you.
I'm always interested in your responses to Law Talk. You can email me at nbomann@wm.edu. You've been listening to Law Talk, the Legal Scholarship Podcast. Technical support is provided by William and Mary Law School. Our theme music was written and performed by John Schmidt. You can find more of John's work online at www.johnschmidt.com. That's J-O-N. And you can find Law Talk online at www.concurringopinions.com.